Now, we're going to turn our attention currently then to, we've been looking at the drugs which activate either directly or indirectly the different cholinergic receptors. Now what we've got to do is to look at the drugs that block cholinergic receptors. Now, since you've got two types of cholinergic receptor, muscarinic and nicotinic, we have to separate our antagonist drugs into muscarinic receptor antagonists and into nicotinic receptor antagonists. For the most part, the muscarinic receptor antagonists can be used interchangeably with the term parasympatholytic. Lytic means the opposite to mimetic. So a parasympathomimetic looks like and acts like acetylcholine, where the parasympatholytic does the opposite. It acts as an antagonist. Well, what we see is first atropine as the prototype. Atropine comes from the belladonna plant, Belladonna atropa, and the belladonna, of course, was given the name from the, the Italian beautiful lady, because it caused a marked pupillary dilation. And I suppose big pupils is beautiful, and that's how it got its name. In any event, it is the prototype of this muscarinic blocking receptor class. It is a tertiary amine and therefore can cross the blood-brain barrier. Now, a lot of the pharmacology is predictable. If you knew what acetylcholine does to, you know, muscarinic receptors, then you knew what would happen if you got in the way of acetylcholine by putting atropine on that receptor. So, for example, acetylcholine actually causes a slowing of the heart. You might predict, actually, that atropine should increase heart rate because it gets in the way of acetylcholine. Actually, moderate to high doses of atropine does actually increase heart rate. But there's actually an anomalous lowering of heart rate at low doses of atropine, which really is very spooky in a sense, isn't it, that that should happen. But the world of medicine is made up with anomalies. And in this case, what seems to happen is that low doses of atropine actually enter the CNS and cause vagal stimulation. And vagal stimulation slows the heart. Reminds you a lot of digitalis, as we'll see later. In any event, moderate doses do what you expect them to do, which is to get in the way of acetylcholine and therefore increase heart rate. You'd expect to decrease secretions, so you would anticipate a dry mouth. You'd probably have some difficulty of drying in the bronchioles if you looked at it as a side effect, but it might be a good thing if you've got excessive bronchiolar secretions, as one often does in pulmonary disease. If you're sweating too much, then atropine would avoid that. On the other hand, it makes it very difficult to control temperature in the sense that our major way of temperature regulation is by sweating. So you might make the prediction then that much of the pharmacology of atropine could be looked at in two lights. One light would be, oh, I like that, and the other light would be, I don't like that. And they're actually both the opposite sides of the same coin in a way. You might want to decrease secretions if you're having excessive salivation, but as a side effect, not having enough saliva means it's very difficult to masticate, to chew, to get food in a way that's readily dissolvable enough to swallow. So it really is good and bad when you look at it. Medriasis, well, that looks like it's not the ideal thing to see a pupillary dilation, however beautiful that may be, because it can interfere with function. But on the other hand, if you're doing an ocular examination, it's nice to paralyze accommodation because then you can see the back of the eye, and that's a clinical use. So you can see that the clinical uses and the adverse effects depends on, you know, how you look at the actions of atropine. Psychoplegia occurs, and this is brought about by paralysis of the ciliary muscle, not the muscles that control the pupil, but the muscles that can control accommodation. Hypothermia. You expect not to be able to sweat, and this then can very easily result in an increase in body temperature. Actually, children particularly, who are notorious for finding it difficult to regulate their body temperature, are particularly prone to hypothermia at even modest doses of a muscarinic blocking drug like atropine. Why do you get vasodilation? You get vasodilation not because you've blocked muscarinic receptors at the vasculature, even though they're there, because if you were to do that, actually you should get vasoconstriction. But you can't do that because there are no nerves to those receptors. But what happens is, if you can't sweat, the only way that you've got through exchange heat is actually to vasodilate, so that you do it by conduction. And so this certainly is one of the anticipated pharmacological actions of atropine. It's seen very vividly in those of us that have light complexions because we go red. And we sometimes call this atropine flush. You get as red as a beetroot, and that is one of the properties of atropine. Atropine decreases GI motility. That sounds like it could be good or bad, doesn't it? I mean, in the sense that if you've got excessive GI motility and you can see your tummy rumbling all the time, maybe you want to sort of cut that down. On the other hand, if you have difficulty in terms of being able to go to the bathroom, that doesn't seem like a very good idea. You know, obviously you can get constipation through decreased GI motility. Atropine crosses the blood-brain barrier and can cause delusions and hallucinations. You know, there are a number of plant products out there that contain atropine. One of them, by the way, is a very common plant in the United States called Jimson weed. Jimson weed, or Jamestown weed, contains muscarinic blocking drugs, and it's very high content in the seeds of Jimson weed. And every now and again you find somebody wants to experience a hallucinatory state, and they'll ingest such seeds and they'll get the symptoms of poisoning due to atropine. The little sets of phrases that you see here might help you, remind you anyway, about some of the properties of muscarinic blockers, including atropine. The decrease in secretions makes you dry as a bone. The vasodilation makes you red as a beet. Because you can't get rid of heat, because you can't sweat, you become hot as a pistol. Because you're midriatic, all right, you've lost your pupil responses, you're blind as a bat. And because of the central nervous system effects, you might be pretty mad, or at least appear to have a state of unusual behavior, which sometimes has been referred to as mad as a hatter. What are you going to do about it? What are you going to do about poisoning? Well, management is to a large extent symptomatic. In other words, we make sure that we bring the body temperature down, we manage to handle any changes in heart rate, etc. Physostigmine, which is a tertiary amine carbamate cholinesterase inhibitor, has certainly been used on many occasions to try and combat atropine poisoning or poisoning with any muscarinic blocking drug. I put a plus and minus here because you have to be very careful in using physostigmine. You might actually convert a situation of atropine poisoning into a situation where you can stop the heart if enough acetylcholine accumulates at the heart by inhibition of the enzyme acetylcholinesterase. So it is not a trivial undertaking to actually use physostigmine in this regard. But in any event, I would like you to have heard of it in that context. Now, we've got many different muscarinic blocking drugs. Atropine is the prototype, and I don't think you have to get too detailed about knowing the names of every one of the other muscarinic blockers out there. I can tell you, just to give you a sense of that, there are at least 8 muscarinic blockers that are pretty much exclusively used for treatment of Parkinson's disease alone. And therefore, you would guess that probably we're well into double figures with the different types of muscarinic blocker. Atropine is certainly clinically used. There's no argument about that. A very good antispasmodic drug, pretty good at drying you up in terms of secretions. Certainly, we mentioned earlier, overdoses due to a cholinesterase inhibitor, and it's present in a number of products that are antidiarrheal. The product Lomatil contains atropine as well as other drug, and that is an antidiarrheal action. We use atropine on the eye for ocular examinations, but it's not the ideal drug because it has too long an action. If I put atropine drops on my eye, I can't see for 24 hours. And therefore, people have developed much shorter acting drugs. Tropicamide is an example. Cyclopentolate is another one of them. And these are used when you go for ocular examinations. They still will interfere with function for an hour or so, but nonetheless, it's much shorter than atropine. If you want a drug that works at the bronchiolar level, and as an example, I've given you ipratropium, you would probably guess that this should bring about a relaxation of bronchiolar smooth muscle, and it would. And ipratropium is used by inhalation, both in asthmatic patients and, to some extent, in patients with chronic obstructive pulmonary dysfunction, COPD. And it works as you would expect. It gets in the way of acetylcholine, and acetylcholine's action on bronchiolar smooth muscle is to cause constriction. So here we should get a relaxation and therefore make it easier to breathe. Most of the drugs used in these topical ways or local ways, like ipratropium, do not cross the blood-brain barrier. Scopolamine, however, does cross the blood-brain barrier and will cause sedation, etc. I always suggest you identify scopolamine in the context of its use in motion sickness. That's the most important clinical use of scopolamine, is in that fashion. It can be used in a variety of ways. One of the ways is actually a patch that you can place behind the ear, and that is a fairly valuable drug in patients who do suffer from motion sickness. Scopolamine is also hallucinogenic, by the way, and is sometimes used in a recreational or illicit fashion, whichever you want to call it, to provide a hallucinatory state. Glycopyrrolate is one of the most commonly used muscarinic blockers. Not only is it antispasmodic and antisecretory, but it also even has a bit of an anti-ulcer action, although muscarinic blocker drugs are not usually thought of as the premier drugs there. We'll deal later with which drugs we're going to use for GI ulcers. People like glycopyrrolate because it doesn't cross the blood-brain barrier, and that makes it useful in peripheral pharmacology without causing any central nervous system effects. So you can see a lot of the differences between the individual muscarinic blockers are more kinetic than they are pharmacodynamic. Do you understand me? That if you don't get there or you do get here, then you've got kinetic differences. That's shown very much by the drug benztropine. Benztropine is a derivative of atropine that actually has a benzene ring on it that allows it to cross the blood-brain barrier. It makes it much more lipid-soluble. And this is the prototype of drugs used in Parkinson's disease, because in Parkinson's you have a relative imbalance between dopamine and acetylcholine. You have actually too much acetylcholine and not enough dopamine, and therefore you sometimes can rectify the balance to a certain degree by giving a muscarinic receptor blocker, and this is working at the level of the striatum in the central nervous system. We also use drugs of this type, like benztropine, to remedy some of the extrapyramidal side effects seen by drugs that are used for the treatment of schizophrenia. So that's certainly another clinical use. Now, what about drugs that block nicotinic receptors? We have two types of drug here, those that block ganglion nicotinic receptors and those that block skeletal muscle nicotinic receptors. The ganglionic blocking drugs have very few clinical uses, if any, these days. However, that does not mean that they aren't important to you. They are important to you because they get asked about in either a direct or indirect way quite commonly. Now, when we were talking about nicotine, we said, well, the effects of nicotine depend on relative innervation and relative dominance of the two branches of the autonomic nervous system. Well, if that were true for nicotine, which activates those receptors, you know it's bound to be true for a drug that would block these receptors. So drugs that are ganglionic blockers have effects that are predictable by innervation and by dominance. Now, let me give you an example. All right, innervation to the vasculature is all sympathetic, right? Which means that we're going to see sympathetic stimulation leading to constriction. So what's a ganglionic blocker going to do to that constriction? Well, if you can't get sympathetic innervation there, how can you get vasoconstriction? So ganglionic blockers are going to cause relaxation of vascular smooth muscle. What's going to happen to blood pressure? It's going to go down. So you can anticipate that. What's going to happen to heart rate? Well, you see, heart rate in certainly the young adult patient is controlled largely by the parasympathetic nervous system, the vagus, and therefore the vagus slows the heart. Now you block the ganglia, you're blocking the vagus. And if you block the vagus, the heart rate will go up. So you can sort of anticipate then the ganglionic blockers will see some degree of stimulation of heart rate, but a big drop in blood pressure. So really it depends on innovation. And I think you could work that out reasonably well by knowing innovation. Now you can see why we spend so much time in reminding you about the innovation of the different target tissues for these drugs. Now, as far as the ability of you to try and remember the names, I've got three names of ganglionic blockers for you here. Hexamethonium, I suppose, still has to be remembered because it was the prototype ganglionic blocker drug. And that certainly is as a feature that makes it worthwhile. Mecamylamine is still used clinically. Trimethoprim, I think, has been off the market, at least in the United States, for the last few years. But they are all ganglionic blocking drugs, and as you see, their effects are going to depend on dominant tone. This is sort of shown in a summary for you in the next figure or slide. This is table 2.5. And as I said already, that since we only have sympathetic innervation for the vasculature, then, and that's designated as SANS, the sympathetic branch of the autonomic nervous system, when you have a ganglionic blocker, you're pretty much guaranteed to get vasodilation, and that's pretty much likely to lower blood pressure. So that would be anticipated. But then, as I told you, there is parasympathetic dominance in the heart, in the young adult anyway, and therefore if you actually interfere with that slowing of the heart, the response is going to be an increase in heart rate or a tachycardia. Parasympathetic's dominant to the pupil in terms of the effect to bring about a meiosis. So what's going to happen with a ganglionic blocker? You're going to get a mydriasis by interfering with that dominance. You're going to see a cycloplegia, again, interfering with the dominant action of the parasympathetic branch of the autonomic nervous system. So these, I'm sure that you can follow them through fairly well in terms of anticipation. It does mean, though, that you've got to know your innervation and you've got to know your dominance. And if you do that, you can work things out fairly well instead of just trying to learn this list of things by rote. It's much better if you understand the principle of it rather than say, I think I'll try and remember 10 things about ganglionic blockers. No, remember 2 things about ganglionic blockers and then work it through from that point. That is the best way to do it. I always recommend that. Now, ganglionic blockers, when they come up in exams, sometimes come up in the context of the fact that they will inhibit reflexes in terms of heart rate. Now, you may remember that whenever you get a change in blood pressure, there are reflexes that occur. So if blood pressure goes up, reflexes lead to a slowing of heart rate or a bradycardia. If blood pressure goes down, then you would anticipate that you'd see a reflex tachycardia. Now, this comes up in the context of identification of a drug's action by virtue of whether it has a direct action on heart rate or whether it actually is indirectly affecting heart rate as a reflex, an autonomic reflex. Now, an autonomic reflex means you've got to go through autonomic ganglia. You can't slow the heart rate without going through a ganglia in terms of the parasympathetic nervous system. You can't raise the heart rate without going through a sympathetic ganglion. Now, what would stop you going through a ganglion? A ganglionic blocker. So ganglionic blockers prevent all autonomic reflexes, period. And in terms of exam questions, it's mainly been directed at preventing reflex tachy or reflex bradycardias. So you can distinguish between whether a drug is acting directly on heart rate or acting out there in the periphery, causing a reflex effect on heart rate by whether or not a ganglionic blocker prevents it. Here's an illustration for you. I've chosen the prototypic ganglionic blocker, hexamethonium. Now, we get, when we use the drug phenylephrine, which is a constrictor of blood vessels, an increase in blood pressure. That increase in blood pressure elicits vagal discharge, which is a reflex action, bringing about a slowing of heart rate. You can't bring that slowing of heart rate if you have used a ganglionic blocker, because it's a reflex, and you prevented the reflex by blocking the ganglion. However, if I was to put acetylcholine on the heart, not easy to do because of its short action. But what about giving a cholinesterase inhibitor, which would increase acetylcholine at the heart? Now, acetylcholine is going to slow the heart, all right? There's no argument about that. But a ganglionic blocker can't prevent that, you see, because ganglionic blockers work at the ganglion. They don't work at receptors in the heart. So acetylcholine will bring about a bradycardia by directly activating muscarinic receptors in the heart. You get the idea? You'll see other illustrations of that later. But right now, that's enough, as long as you know what they're up to in terms of designing questions of drug identification by bringing in to a particular question the action of a ganglionic blocking drug. If you can do that, I think it'll be very valuable for you. Now, what about the other blockers of nicotinic receptors that work at the skeletal muscle junction? We have two types of drug here. One type, which has as its prototype D-tubocurare, prevents depolarization of the end plate. And for that reason, they're called non-depolarizing blocking agents. So in other words, they bind to the receptor and prevent depolarization. By preventing it, of course, they're working as antagonists. They happen to be competitive antagonists, and you might remember that competitive antagonism can be reversed by increasing the activity of an agonist drug. And one can do that with this class of drugs by actually using a cholinesterase inhibitor. If one actually uses the drug for muscle relaxation, skeletal muscle relaxation, and you want to terminate that so that you get muscle contractility back again, then you administer a cholinesterase inhibitor, and that allows acetylcholine to accumulate, and it overcomes the blockade caused by this class of drugs. D-tubocurare is the prototype. I think you should identify that. I'm not so enthusiastic about the other 9 or 10 drugs in this class. You can usually identify them, by the way, by looking at what the word is. If there's a curium or if there's an onium in the sound of the name, they're probably going to be drugs that resemble curare. So, for example, atracurium resembles curare, and pancuronium resembles curare. It would be much more profitable for you to know that than to try and identify, you know, every individual non-depolarizing blocking drug. On the other hand, you will remember just the one drug that happens to be a depolarizing skeletal muscle relaxant, and that is the drug succinylcholine, which actually is very closely related chemically to acetylcholine. This actually causes depolarization of the end plate, but unlike acetylcholine, the depolarization is maintained. So what happens is you get a muscle twitch, a fasciculation, and then because you cannot repolarize the end plate, the muscle becomes flaccid. In order for you to get contraction, you've got to get repolarization of the end plate. So you lose your contractive activity, and so the muscle relaxes. This is very different, isn't it, from drugs like curare. Curare prevent depolarization. This drug actually depolarizes the end plate. And it isn't working as an antagonist. It's actually working as an agonist, rather like acetylcholine. Now, this drug is not readily reversed by cholinesterase inhibitors. Fortunately, in most patients, that doesn't matter very much because its duration of action is just a few minutes, so you really don't get excited about actually having to reverse it. But in certain patients who have a deficiency of pseudocholinesterase, which metabolizes succinylcholine, such patients may have a protracted muscle relaxation, and it may be that one has to ventilate that patient for a more persistent period of time. This is an example of genotypic variations in drug metabolism. The cholinesterases involved catalyze a hydrolytic reaction, hydrolyzing acetylcholine, and as I said, that there are variants between different patients in whether they have the full a number of enzymes that are the cholinesterases, or whether they have a partial or even sometimes a significant deficiency in that enzyme.